UK Motor Talk.
Well, hello everyone, and you join us for episode 200 of UK Motor Talk.
That was my fanfare. Did you like that?
Fanfare for the, well, not for the common man, but fanfare for the gym.
The uncommon man.
It's something, isn't it? How are we all?
Top bombing.
Still vertical.
Very well, hanging in there.
And by now you know who we are, so let's get to it. Being our 200th episode, we thought we would have a look back over some of the things that we've done over our 200 episodes, and of course all the other bits and pieces we've done. So we've got a few categories, and I think we should start off with, out of the cars you've driven, reviewed, owned, what have you, what's been the most fun, Dave?
Oh god, well, I've had quite a lot of fun being driven by others. Particularly, I mean, obviously it's more fun to drive yourself if you can drive. You have a bit more say in what's going on, but it is fun to be driven in things you might not normally get to drive yourself, and it's the next best thing. As anyone who's familiar with UK Motor Talk, particularly over the last 200 episodes worth, will know, we are quite familiar with the old Goodwood estate, and that's been responsible for some of the more fun things I've done, I have to say. I mean, sort of going up the hill a few years ago in Nick Mason's then new Alfa Romeo 8C, that was quite impressive.
Clang.
Especially, well, clang, yes, but there's a few more coming, because as we were trickling out of the paddock to go down to the start line, Mason himself leant into the car and asked the guy who was driving it for him, James Racing Driver, who basically drives all of them for everyone, asked him if he wouldn't mind not bending it because his daughter was driving it home that evening, and then leant across and said, have a nice drive, and shook his hand, said thank you very much. And yes, we did have a very nice drive, and it was, yes, quite impressive to have met a Nick Mason, but to have been sat in his car and be hurtled up the hill at 100 miles an hour or whatever it was. And yeah, that was quite fun. And also hurtling across the grass in a massive great Paris-Dakar support truck when three of us were sat there abreast trying to hold on to our lunch, and various batteries flying out of recorders at one point as well. So I don't think it ever got, actually, there's no evidence of it. It never got recorded. But that was a huge amount of fun. You know, Goodwood has been good to me personally, I think to all of us. But it's provided me with some fun times.
One had to be careful with a Goodwood lunch, because if you were too indulgent on those days when they provided a very, very good lunch for the media days, it was very easy to have a very good lunch and lose it an hour later while going up the hill. Yeah, Goodwood's been very, very good to all of us, I think, over the years.
How about you, Jim?
Most fun car. Well, there's two spring to mind. Number one, obviously, is the Caterham 7, which I've, I would say, not long acquired, but it's been about a year now, actually, because it's not too far off time.
Really?
Yeah, not too far off time to book the MOT, to be fair. It had a fresh MOT on it when I bought it. And there's, I'm not far off having to book the MOT. So it was about May time when I got it. So, yeah, that's got to be up there. But fairly close to that, I think, is our Fiesta ST, which we've waxed lyrical about on the podcast. But a very specific time, I think it was after run 3 at Snetterton, where we had that flat tyre. So we put the old tread pattern, had sat in the corner of a shed for many, many years, old Toyo on the left rear, and just the hilarity of the handling that ensued. So for that very specific moment in time, that one. But the Fiesta, for what it's given us, I think, for some good trips out and days out and meeting new people and whatever else, has been very good to us. I think that's a good little car and very good value for money as well.
It is, but I will just point out here that you sent me out first on the ancient hard tyre. I went into the first corner and good God, what's happened? And it just completely broadside when you weren't expecting it. The handling went from being very predictable to suddenly not very predictable to being, it's predictable in one direction, but not in the other.
Yeah, but it was on the left rear. And of course, as with most circuits in the UK, they all turn clockwise. So it's the perfect place to put the tyre with no grip is on the left rear.
Well, there's an argument for it, but it was still terrifying the first time I went out, I have to say. I wouldn't say that was fun. I think that was a brown trouser moment, that one. I definitely felt everything through bomb hole on that one. I really did. Really
through
did.
The bomb hole.
Through the bomb hole. For me, it's tricky. We've had so many great cars we've got into it and just gone, this is hilarious fun. The Alpine A110 is definitely a highlight for me, but also some crazy stuff that we've had a chance to go in a tank or something, perhaps. For me, cars I've owned, the most fun has probably been my Mark 7 Fiesta ST. Sensible power upgrade, mount tune from new, 215 horsepower. And it had that beautiful blend of usable power where you could go full throttle and not be always going through the limit. So you could enjoy it down a country road. It would just grip and go. And it was just an exceptional, exceptional car. And one that I'm going to go out there and say it's going to be a classic, that thing. I think that would be the XR2. Of the future, that'd be the one that people go back and buy, that Mark 7 Fiesta ST. There you go.
And I think as the time comes to replace our beloved Mark 6 ST, I think it will be a Mark 7 that we replace it with, won't it?
I think it makes the most sense. They're so tunable. I was one of our guys at work, well, two of our guys at work have got them actually, and one's got one that's theoretically about 360 horsepower these days. And it's insane. He was regaling me with some of the tales of Goodwood on Friday. He was out for a track day and he was out there just absolutely bashing Golf R's that were tuned up and getting away with it, to the extent where when he was out and then racing the Yaris GRs and like round, that he was being cheered on by the same guys who couldn't catch him, which I think is quite nice. So yeah, they've got a huge amount of potential, but even in a stock tune are still pretty good fun. Lots of lift off oversteer is what you want in a small, fizzy, front-wheel drive, hot hatch. And, well, you can pick them up for less than $5,000 now. So I don't know why you even listen to me now. Go out there and buy one. Actually, no, listen to this first. While you're listening to this, go on to whichever auction site or whatever buying site you want to go on and then have a look for one and then buy one. But continue listening. There you go.
Perhaps surprisingly, the most fun car I think that I've owned, and I seem to have owned quite a lot of cars over the years, was a Ford. Because many years ago, I owned a Mark II Cortina that I bought from a Ford mechanic who'd basically taken what had been a 1600E, which was quite a quick vehicle anyway in his day, and upgraded it so that it was essentially a Mark II Lotus Cortina. Ooh. And I lived out in the countryside at the time. There was somebody a couple of villages away that had a genuine Mark II Lotus Cortina. And I used to thrash the backside off this thing. It was great fun. Really enjoyed it. You know, brilliant handling. I mean, it was, even before track days had been first thought of, it was a track day car. It's great fun on the road. Really, really enjoyed it. Yet it was still docile enough that I could use it as a family car.
It was the kind of era where family cars, you could still compete in a clubman sort of style, couldn't you? With an Escort, if you had an Escort Mexico, you could still use it as your everyday car. It was still the era where you'd see cars on a racetrack with number plates on.
Yeah, yeah.
I was driving across beautiful Surrey on Sunday and spotted an MGB coming the other way, which was debumpered and looked like it was all in proper race tune with little like polycarbonate deflectors over the headlamps, and it'd been had all the little tow tags and stuff hanging out through the gaps in the body. So it looked like it'd been properly set up, and it sounded like it was running Webers or something similar. It sounded beautiful as it came thundering through the opposite direction, but with number plates on, of course. So I guess you could take it out, drive it down the pub if you wanted to, and then the next day take it to a track or the other way around, depending on your preference, but preferably not track straight after the pub. But nevertheless, a great way of being able to spend an afternoon. That sounds like it should lead us nicely on then to the most surprising car that we've owned, tested, or driven. I get the feeling you've got a story for us there, Graham.
I'll tell you a story of the car that gave me the biggest fright I've ever got and just showed up how little I actually knew about driving. Silverstone Grand Prix circuit. Derek Bell, he'd invited me up there because he was testing something. And I was asked to bring the full race gear that I had then and was sat in a Porsche 962. In what had been one of his Le Mans successful cars. And it just scared the pants off me. It just was so awesomely powerful. It accelerated so fast. It was just interstellar rocket ship. And I'd driven some pretty quick cars, but nothing quite as raw as that. I got to what was my top speed limit, and then I got in alongside Derek again. And he found another 20 or 30 miles an hour on top of that. So by then we're doing nearly 200 miles an hour.
Wow.
But, you know, if you won five times at Le Mans and been world champion a couple of times and so on and so on and so on, then you know your stuff. I certainly proved that day that I didn't. You know, I thought I was reasonably handy and had a reasonable amount of experience, and that scared the shit out of me. But it's still great fun. I think I've referred to this before, but I'll do so just for the purposes of taking you back an awful long way to cross-ply tyres. As I drove a Jaguar C-Type, which is a favourite car of mine, 1953 Jaguar C-Type, on racing cross-plies. And every roundabout, you just never knew where the thing was going to go. You know, modern tyre structures are so much stiffer, they're so much more predictable. Greatest of respect for the people that could drive those in racing circumstances, but slightly worn cross-ply racing tyres, and it was all over the place. I loved every minute of it, but it was all over the place.
Jim, what surprised you?
Well, I think, again, I'll do a top two. I think second place honourable mention is the BMW i4 M50, whatever it was, diddle. I think that that certainly surprised the pair of you as well, didn't it? And I think
it's the one that made Andrew sick, wasn't it?
It certainly had me giggling for a large amount of time. So that was surprising in many ways, not just the rapid pace and the straight line speed. It was the cornering, the grip, the handling, the change of direction and everything. But I think for, if you're a little bit less experienced, then something can always shock you a bit more. And it was a customer's car that had been recovered to us at my old dealership. And it was turned up on the back of a low loader. Never seen the car before, had no idea whose it was. It just got dropped off and no idea what was wrong with it, whose it was, what we were supposed to do with it. But a couple of days later, the phone rang and the guy told us what was up with it and what he wanted doing. So we got stuck into it. But then I'd asked him about the engine in it. So I said, it's not a normal K-series lump in the back of your S1 Elise, is it? So we had a little chat about it. And he said, well, when it's all done, take it for a drive. Let me know what you think. So, oh, no, I couldn't do that. It's not there for... Oh, no, take it for a spin, see what you think. And so I did. I toddled off up the road this thing, and I was in my, I don't know, early 20s, you know, 21, 22, something like that. And he dropped into his S1 Elise a 1.8 VW Audi turbo engine into it, and then wound it up like anything. And Jesus, it went, this thing. But it just had that hilarious sort of turbo lag, and then wallop, everything came in at once. And it was just, it just made you giggle like anything. It was hilariously quick, this thing. But he'd spent a lot of time and effort getting the engine in and winding the power up. He said, I haven't quite sort of got around to sorting the handling all the brakes or the whatever to cope with the extra power on it. You know, the handling of the S1 Elise is pretty much perfect, but it's designed with a certain amount of power in mind. So he said, I need to stiffen a few things up and sort a few bits and pieces out. But that was an hilariously quick car. So very good fun and very surprising.
It was the BAM engine, I assume, that's in that. It's quite, that tunes really well if it's the same one.
It was I think it was north of 400 brake horsepower, this thing, in wow. What does an S1 Elise weigh? 600 kilos?
Not many.
I don't know. I've had heavier lunches. Something like that. To be honest.
Yeah, it was insane. So it's about the same weight as the Caterham, isn't it? And that's sprightly enough with 150 brake horsepower. So yeah, treble that. Mm. And that was entertaining, to say the least.
Dave, your most surprising car.
Well, again, I mean, it sort of goes off the back of what Jim's just been talking about. It's in a similar vein, two things probably. One, long time ago, and it does involve turbo lag. As anyone who's been bored by my recollections of cars I've had over the years will know, I had a fleet, one after the other, of Uno turbos. God knows why, but I think I must have banged my head at some point and thought, well, that'd be a good idea, I'll have another one. Never learn.
Like, oh, they look cool.
Well, they're fantastic cars, but each one did its best to bankrupt me, but I didn't learn from the previous. Oh, this one will be all right. Was it the definition of insanity? But anyway, the first one I had was quite an old one even then. It was a D-Reg, and it had the Knight Rider dashboard. And I was going from an Uno 60 with its 1.1 engine, which, you know, is a great little car. It's a fantastic little thing. But, you know, I'd sort of been earning a bit and thought, I know, it'd be quite fun. I'd like an Uno Turbo. And this one, you know, wasn't the best example, but it was cheapish and it's an Uno. I like Unos, but definitely want the Turbo. Went along, test drove it. Well, I was just about to test drive it, and the guy said, yeah, just take it around the block. He said, but just be careful. He was looking at the car I'd come in. He said, it will feel like that to start with. It'll feel slower, but all of a sudden things will catch up with you pretty quick. So just, you know, be one of, oh, yeah, whatever. It's an Uno. It's just got a slightly faster engine. It took it around the block. So, I think it was somewhere in Carshalton or somewhere around that way. Coming around the car, I thought, God, this thing feels dead. What's all the hype about with these things? So, you know, put my foot down, first gear, sort of going up around the back of Carshalton Beaches somewhere, and all of a sudden, all effing hell broke loose. I mean, nowadays, it would probably feel tame as anything, but when you've gone from an Uno 60 with 60 horsepower and basically a linear acceleration to an Uno Turbo where it's on or off, that surprised me. And from that point on, I was hooked. The giggle factor was strong with those. And as they progressed, I think, because the one I had originally was a D-Reg, so it was one of the first, sort of, I think they started a sort of B, C-Reg somewhere along then, sort of 84, 85. This one was sort of D, so that would be 86 or 87. I think they were starting to improve the responsiveness, but the next one I had was far better, or perhaps I was just more used to them, but it certainly didn't feel like the on-off switch. But the on-off switch did make it fun. It did sort of, you could surprise people. When you got used to it and you knew what you were doing, you could surprise your friends and have them sort of begging you not to do it anymore, which again, was quite good fun. But the other thing, which again involves a lot of slightly more controllable power, but a lot more of it, was the first time I got taken out in a Tesla and shown the full gamut of what that thing can do when it's in silly mode, and even not in silly mode. I think it was ludicrous mode. It's when I was still doing the advanced driving thing as an observer, and there were a couple of us actually out, and you know, people, this is when sort of Teslas and such like were still very much the novelty, and we were trying to get our heads around how do we deal with this on a sort of coaching and observing level. So this guy was, you know, he's pretty handy, and he'd not had this thing long. It was a P100D version of the type, you know, was it the Type S, you know, the one they don't
import Model S.
Anymore. The Model S, that's the one, the bigger one. And he took us out and he said, look, he said, I know I'm supposed to be within the bounds of holiness here, but is it, you know, do you want me to demonstrate what this thing can do? And we sort of, well, why do you think we're here? So he took it down this road, did the warm up where it sort of warms the batteries, and said, right, you're up for this. Ludicrous, but he said, warn you, he said, brace yourselves. So he did. And my God, I don't think I've ever experienced anything like it. It's like being, you know, the first time you experience this thing, as I'm sure everyone here has experienced it now, but that first thing where it just feels like God has got the palm of his hand and has just gone bang and pushed you into the seat and just will not stop. It's just like nothing else. When you first experience that with no gear changes, no let up, just linear acceleration, it's like being a particle in the old CERN thing. It's I imagine that must be what it feels like. It's an unpleasant feeling, but one, you know, you also want to giggle, but you can't because you can't get your breath. It's that was pretty shocking rather than surprising. And when you get used to it, it's all right. But unfortunately, after that, you realise that basically the car's a one-trick pony and it's built poorly and bits are falling apart and it's got a big screen that I don't like. But the party trick, I don't think I'll ever forget that.
We drove the Model S Plaid when we were up at Birmingham not long ago and did the launch, the 1.9 seconds to 60 launch in the new one. And they've come a long way in terms of their interior quality from the early ones in probably about 2013, 14 or something, I think it was, to the one that's now left-hand drive only. But I know what you mean. Good God, is that quick? That is really, really quick.
Very. It rearranges you. The joke about feeling your organs being rearranged, I don't think it's a joke. I swear to God, I could feel bits of me moving inside that shouldn't have been.
But the trouble is, once you've rearranged your organs, put them back in their correct positions, you then want to do it again because that's what we do.
Exactly. Well, we did a couple of times, but after a while, I think there was a genuine feeling of nausea. It becomes too much, and after a while, I mean, it completely resets all your points of reference. That's the thing. I mean, it's like when you're behind one and you see it do the trick and disappear off in front of you. It's otherworldly because you're used to things dipping down and then dipping down again as it changes gear and dipping down again, but doing it in hops, whereas this thing just dips down and goes. It's like the Martians have landed, but they've still got four wheels. It's weird, weird feeling, but great fun after a while.
They don't look much, do they? I think the first time you drive an EV that's got any sort of poke to it, you get to do the sit at the traffic lights and you're in an SUV or whatever it might be. Someone sits next to you and they're revving, they're inching forward ready to go, and you just foot flat down and disappear. It is quite satisfying as you sort of waft off in your sense of self-satisfaction and green credentials. It is good fun to do it, though. For me, the most surprising... Actually, before I do that, you mentioned about the turbo and it's surprising you. There is something I must tell you about this. This is a friend of a friend was once told back in the early noughties, he had a Fiesta RS turbo, which had a similar sort of thing. We had a wallop and then it went. That there was no speed record for reverse. So what came as a massive surprise to him, as you can probably imagine, was reversing down a country lane at full throttle. And I'll leave you to imagine how that ended up. Largely backwards in a field. but yeah, that I should imagine came as a complete and utter surprise in a car.
That's when you find out there's a reason that any car that has rear wheel steering, it does 1 or 2 degrees and that's about it, isn't it?
Yes. I think it came around a bit quick, like a forklift truck. But there's many times I've been surprised in a car. Firstly, shuffling across a Toyota Auris, one of the early ones that had the Durex handbrake that stuck up in the middle of the dashboard. That came as a surprise, an unwelcome one, I hasten to add. But also, probably the most surprising car that I've driven. Actually, I started off in the back, having my insides rearranged, and that is the Audi S8. This is a car that we drove at Millbrook as an SMMT test day, and I thought it'd be a good idea to sit in the back and to be able to deliver a review from the back seat whilst being pilled around there at exactly the 55 miles an hour speed limit, and then got a chance to drive it. I've never driven something that's so unbelievably big with so much torque that the world would spin backwards when you put your foot down, I think, rather than the car catapulting itself off. But that handled so unbelievably well. This was the size of a yacht, this thing. Absolutely massive. But again, with very clever adaptive suspension and steering and everything else, that meant you could just catapult round a corner at an ungodly speed. The body control was really, truly surprising. I honestly expected it to be a land yacht, and it just wasn't.
But it was nice to be wafted around in, wasn't it? It was one of those cars that manages to be great to drive and great to be driven in, as long as the driver isn't driving like a complete flute, it has to be said, up to the 55 mile an hour speed limit, of course.
Yes, yeah, indeed. Dare I say that theoretically it would almost be possible to get air in something that's quite that heavy. It really is truly, truly surprising, and certainly something that if you had the means and you'd gone out and driven it, you would come back and buy it, because I think it did an incredible job of moving things and people around, as you say, in complete comfort, and then just being an absolute lunatic of a car. Genuinely, really surprising. Next up, most unusual. Weirdest, freakiest, from the weirdest place. What's the most unusual thing that you've ever driven?
I've driven an OB truck. That was scary, tell you, when you're sort of 17 years old and not long past your test and being told, right, you're qualified to drive a 7.5 tonner. Learned to drive pretty quick driving those. I mean, back in the very, very old days, I started out as a trainee engineer, junior engineer, broadcast engineer, and the company I worked for had an OB truck, which an outside broadcast.
Not the character from Hollyoaks.
Never seen it, never will. not the target audience, I'm very pleased to say. No, not that, whatever that is. But no, it was an outside broadcast truck for broadcast of television and such like. It wasn't a very big one. I mean, some of the things you see these days are articulated and the sides come out and they're sort of three times the size of what you normally see. And this thing was basically, it was a Ford, you know, the Ford late 80s, whatever the chassis was, not too long, but it was heavy, very heavy, because it had a lot of very heavy kit in the back of it. So they, you know, passed my driving test. It was right, now you can drive the vans. So there were like Renault traffic vans, and there was Renault, you know, the little Renault 5 type vans and master vans and all this. And the other thing I got to drive there as well, which was pretty cool, was the Sierra Estate, the 2.9i 4x4, which had a load of broadcast kit and a big aerial that stuck out the top and a load of other aerials. So it whistled when it went along. I think we may have spoken about this sort of thing before. But then they said, right, the OB needs taking down to wherever it was to have a new tyre put on it. There's the keys. Off you go. And that was an interesting experience. I mean, fortunately, I had somebody with me who had driven it before. But I think they were blooding me and thinking this could be quite useful. Well, because I used to do everything. I was literally the gopher. So you'd go for this, go for that. It was basically a glorified runner, but with a soldering iron. But it was great. It taught me a lot, and it taught me that I didn't want to drive trucks for a living. But it was an experience. And the sitting high up and the having to plan your corners and all your manoeuvres and sort of go wide and all that sort of thing, it was an experience, but it was... It was odd. I mean, it's not an odd thing for a lot of people to drive, but for a 17 and a bit year old, I mean, nowadays you wouldn't be allowed to drive it, I don't think, and certainly not that young. But it was an unusual thing for me to drive at the time, perhaps a bit tame, but it was a bit of a shock.
My early driving experience was similar, but not the same. Certainly not a 7.5 tonner, but I'd gone straight from passing my driving test and came into work one day, and I was working at B&Q. And I used to be a heavy doing all the building materials and lifting all the big stuff and carrying it around, that kind of stuff. And my manager said, can you give us a hand to chuck this bathroom suite on the back of the van? And we had a super jumbo wide-bodied Luton, one of the six-wheeled ones with the tail lift and stuff on the back. So nowhere near as big as that, but still a reasonable size. Loaded the thing in the back. He says, it's got to go to some flats in Worthing. Would you come with me? I said, yeah, of course, no problem. Went to jump in the truck. He goes, what are you doing? I said, what do you mean, what am I doing? I'm going with you, aren't I? And he goes, yeah. He said, but I haven't got a driving license. I said, I've just passed my test. So I've only driven a Corsa. He went, well, it's all the same, isn't it? I said, well, how do you know? You've never driven. I mean, if you haven't got a driving license, how can you make that judgment? So that was the wake-up call, was learning to drive that early on. It was before we had sensors and cameras and bits and pieces. So it was all using your mirrors and hoping and praying and then parking in the middle of Arundel or whatever it might be in a space that was absolutely tiny. Down a very narrow street and as quickly as you possibly could to avoid just angry residents behind you queuing up to park or try and circle to try and park themselves whilst you're getting in their way. But it is an eye-opener and it does teach you to drive, I think, hopefully, with that bit better, maybe if not, maybe with just a bit more awareness. And still to this day, when I reverse or manoeuvre whatever, I end up using the side mirrors probably more than I do anything else. I've got a camera in my car. I'd never really look at it. I just end up looking, say, in the side mirrors. I hardly use the middle one for doing the same thing and just tucking it into spaces. But it was more helpful than harmful, I suppose. It's quite an experience. I can't imagine what it would have been like to be chucked the keys to a 7.5 tonner instead. I think this thing was bad enough. 3.5 tons.
Scary. It was scary.
Like you, I was 17. I was doing a summer job as a bus conductor. And we just finished our shift and the driver said to me, just park it in the depot, will you, son? And I'll go and organise a bit of dinner for us. This was to be paid for out of the profits we've made on reselling some of the recently used tickets. But there we are. There's a French admission.
Right, you butler.
But unfortunately, in reversing very carefully this double-decker, I'd forgotten that there's a particular light fitting that ran all the way around this really old sort of Edwardian depot, just at the height of the rear window, and I managed to pop it through the rear window. So I did own up to the driver, and when I went up for the dinner, and he said, don't worry about it, these things happen. Which, there you go, I thought was a very reasonable act. I'm sure the inspector, had he not gone home by then, would have had some different words to say, but there you go. It was my first attempt to park a bus, and it was not successful. It lined up quite nicely. It was just about 6 inches too far to the rear.
I don't think I've driven anything that unusual, really, so maybe that's a resolution for this year, to try and drive something unusual, like a Sinclair C5 or a Peel P50 or something like that. I think the most unusual car I've driven, I suppose, would be a smart car, because it's unusual to call something like that a car, really, because it kind of looked like a car and is described as a car and sold as a car, but it didn't really drive or handle or do anything like a normal car. So I don't know, unless we're counting sort of TVRs and bits and pieces like that, that just everything on there is unusual, really, isn't it? Sort of how you open the door's unusual. Does that count?
Yes, it does with TVRs, certainly, and Marcos.
Yeah, I guess it's a tricky different. One. Through the nature of what we do, we've driven a load of random things. So lots of left-hand drive, odd spec, weird machines. We've driven some heavy quads, which are sort of cars, but not. As I've mentioned before, my father-in-law's got a double-decker bus. That's a bit unusual. I guess probably the most unusual for me, and they're not unusual to see them on the road, but most unusual is probably some of the emergency service vehicles that we've got to drive through the course. I suppose most people probably wouldn't. So police cars and fire engines and bits and pieces like that, ambulances, are relatively unusual. And hearses. So not things that most people normally drive, but all of which have a very different way people treat you when you're on the road. If you're driving a police car, you notice everyone slows down a bit and goes past you gently. When I did my advanced driving thing, when I passed my test in a Volvo with all the chevrons on the back, and that was quite an education, driving up to central London and around. Probably the funniest one for me, though, was we were driving over to deliver a Ranger, a fire engine Ranger. It was during lockdown, and as you were driving along, people were going, thank you, you know, just putting their hand up saying, thanks, little thumbs up. Just doing my job. Just literally, hang on a second. There I am in a blue shirt. I see presumably people thought, you know, obviously.
We don't get a round of applause when we go and pick up a car from the auctions nowadays, do we?
No, we don't. So that was a very unusual experience. And then as we were nearing the destination, an ambulance decided to turn round with the blues on to try and head back the other way and basically got stuck. Now, we were in a recovery fire engine with a winch on the front. So you're thinking, people are obviously at this point trying to squeeze past, you have no idea what's going on or whatever. So what do you do? Sit there, put the stationary lights on or something and hope for the best. I could just see us having to tow this thing out, this ambulance out with the blues on. And it was quite an unusual day, but was quite amusing just to be thanked so much by passing traffic for something that we absolutely could take no credit for. But it was fun. Okay, moving on now to worst car you've ever reviewed. Graham, you've got a huge amount of cars under your belt. What's the worst one?
Well, I have mentioned it before, so I'll be fairly brief. It didn't last long on the UK market. It was an Indian Jeep called the Mahindra. And it's the only vehicle I've ever felt seasick in, despite being driven in all kinds of things and all kinds of speeds and so on and so on. But the suspension on it was so weird, so awful. I actually took it back after about an hour. I was supposed to have it for a weekend. And said to the dealer, look, basically, it'll either get a terrible review or you just take it back and we'll forget all about it and I'll do something else. And that's what we did because it wasn't worth upsetting. He was a good customer of that newspaper group and he knew it was crap. And he'd only got the one, and he did manage to foist it off on some farmer a little bit later. But then they pulled them from the market. So I think they sold three or four in the entirety of the UK. But they were truly, truly awful.
Dave?
Reviewing is probably not something I've done a huge amount of. Having driven some pretty shocking things, one that really springs to mind was a hire car we were given when we went to Cyprus one year. A Perodua badged version of a Daihatsu Terios, it's not a bad car. The Daihatsu Terios, the one from the sort of mid-2000s, that sort of era, was actually pretty capable.
They're not bad.
They're a Terrier.
It was a good little car. They were really good. They were capable. They never pretended to be anything, but, you know, they could get you out of trouble and you could probably go and play in them quite nicely. They weren't pretentious. They weren't a lifestyle vehicle. They were, you know, this could do the business if it had to, but, you know, it just gives you a bit of, bit of a feeling. If you do live somewhere a little bit more rural, that you probably get where you need to go if the weather got a bit nasty, that sort of thing. Anyway, we turn up at the airport at whatever time, it's about 2-3 in the morning, the bloke's there to meet you, give you the car, and then off you go into the dock to go and find where you're staying. And this thing, I don't know, it's hard to describe. Basically, it's like they'd taken, and I can't take credit for this description, but it is a good one. It's like they'd taken the Daihatsu Terios, covered it in super glue, and then ram-raided Halfords for every single stick-on part you can get. It was like a metallic, light pink purple colour. It had twin headlight conversion. It had body kit down to pretty much the floor. The wheels were inboard by about 6 inches. It looked like nothing else. It looked like if somebody was stereotypically trying to describe the campest car you could possibly hire anywhere in the world, this would be it. And, you know, it was great. It was automatic, point and go and all this sort of thing. But my God, it was shameful to drive this thing. So we tended not to go anywhere in it during the day, just go out at night and go and get something to eat. But it was, I've got photos of it somewhere. I'll share with the group. It was an experience. I mean, after a while it became funny. It was a funny thing, but it was, it's not something I'd have chosen. Put it that way. The Perodua Kembara. That's it. That was the name of it. It became the mighty Perodua Kembara in our tenure. It was anything but. But it had very efficient air conditioning. I know that because the engine practically stalled every time you switched it on.
Jim, what's your worst?
Nissan Qashqai.
Yeah.
Don't need to say any more than that, really, do I? Just no, not a single redeeming feature to any generation of Nissan Qashqai I've ever had the misfortune to drive. But there we go.
They are a dull car. They're one of those cars you get in, you've bought it purely because it's a thing that can carry things.
White goods. Automotive white goods.
The new one looks quite nice. But yeah, historically, the one that was around in the mid-noughties particularly. Ugh.
A friend of mine in France bought one of the first series, and it was, I think your description, Dave, is just about right. Just automotive white goods. It was just bland. But it was at least reasonably well screwed together. And my friend kept it, I think, for 2 or 3 years, traded him for a new one. And he lives in southern France, and we just happened to be visiting. He said, I've just got this one a couple of weeks ago. What do you think of it? I said, have you noticed anything about the bonnet fit? Of course, the bonnet fit was, you wouldn't have got a fag paper down one side, and it was about 3/4 of an inch high on the other side. I mean, it looked like somebody jumped all over the bonnet. And he said, well, it came like that. Well, take it back, because it isn't bloody well supposed to. You know, your cats could escape out of one side, but not out of the other. Awful, awful. It was some of the worst production I've ever seen.
It's just the Nissan meh, really, wasn't it? It's just, there you go, that'll do you. But, I mean, it's transport. The problem is, for the vast majority of people that bought them, it was brilliant. It did the job. It got them everywhere they wanted to go. But for people like us, it's the antithesis of everything we'd ever want. Really, isn't it? It's ultimate, you know, it's an A to B machine, and that's your lot.
He lived in the country, and it was just a vehicle to shift stuff, basically.
If you want that kind of thing, buy a Berlingo, because people think they look attractive and sexy in a 4x4 and stuff, and they're better than the other mum trucks, of the time, the sort of Renault Scenics and C-Maxes. But they just do exactly the same job, and I don't think they look any better, really, the Qashqai. But I get you. I've had the misfortune of driving and testing some dreadful cars in the past. Cars which are unashamedly cheap, I can kind of let go to an extent, like the Matiz, which was cheap and rubbish, but didn't pretend to be anything other really than cheap and rubbish. There's been some cheap and good ones, like the Aygo, which is a cheap and excellent car, the original Aygo. The Lissetti was a miserable car, one that I always hated driving. But I reserve a special hatred in my heart for the Chrysler Sebring. I've so many of those, so many, and they were always silver or grey with badly corroded alloys. I don't know if they used bits of old Mercedes in the same way the 300C did, which I equally wasn't a massive fan of, a bit of a disappointment, but not dreadful. But the Sebring, oh my God, it pretended to be a posh car, but it wasn't. It was very American inside, very plastic. Bongs when it does everything, a separate key fob to open it up to the actual key that started it. The handbrake was made of plastic. But it did teach me one thing, and that was that however much I particularly hated a car, and oh my goodness, did I hate that, there's usually at least one redeeming feature in every car that I drive that I do like. And it had heated and cooled cup holders, and I thought that was an excellent invention. So if you had a can of pop, you could put it in there and it would keep it cold for you, or it would go wrong and make it very hot.
That's a great idea.
It's a great idea.
Yeah, brilliant. Brilliant idea.
For all of its faults, it had a stupidly awkward small access boot, all the rest of it. It was a rubbish car, but an excellent cup holder. So there you go. There is the silver lining in the grey cloud that is the Chrysler Sebring. miserable car.
Demonstration of running before you can walk, Chrysler. Yes, that's very nice. You've got very nice cup holders, but could you actually make the thing something that somebody might actually want to own to find out that it's got heated and cooled cup holders, please?
And I think probably my real issue with the 300C was the fact that people would buy them and stick Bentley badges on them. It also was a bit pathetic.
I quite like the 300C, but it wasn't a Bentley. It isn't a Bentley. It was a Rover 3-litre coupe.
It was an E-Class estate underneath, is what it was.
Yeah.
An old E-Class estate. So if you went into it on the understanding that it would drive like an old E-Class estate with a big body on it, then I guess it was kind of okay. And I remember parking one of these up, and I had a trainee manager that I was training. I was parked up down the road, and I asked him to go and get it. And unbeknownst to him, we owned the two cars that were either side of it. I got one of the other guys to go down and just move them really close. And this thing was incredibly long. It was like turning a battleship. And he had maybe 10 inches, I think, at either end of the car. And he was gone for a very long time getting that out of the space. A very, very long time. And it was when parking sensors were very tedious. And occasionally had the little monitors that you'd see in the rearview mirror where it would go from orange to red to let you know that you were getting close to something and then beep very loudly. That was quite amusing, I suppose. But, well, it was amusing for us. It wasn't necessarily amusing for him. Childish behaviour on our part.
I did find out when I was testing cars regularly, but certainly one or two dealers I found out, they would intentionally, if they knew that I was coming to pick up a car, they would park it in the most difficult place imaginable. Because that was part of getting back at me, because I had the temerity to borrow one of their cars for the weekend. Cheeky bastards. But it didn't usually reflect badly in the review, but sometimes it did. Sometimes I got my own back.
Lucky you. It's a good job. I didn't wind the heating up and guff in it.
They were always supposed to put a reasonable amount of fuel in the car. And I remember picking up it was a Jag, if I remember rightly. And I drove it off the forecourt and it promptly stopped. As I was on the off-ramp from their forecourt. It had no fuel in it whatsoever.
How very Jag.
It must be a tiny breath of fuel in it. So they had to haul it back in and put some fuel in it before I would test it. Again, cheeky buggers.
Okay, one to wrap up then. Favourite interview. I suspect, Graham, we should leave you to last as our chief interviewer, because I'd imagine you have many, many favourites from many, many big names.
Yeah, I'm going to be restrictive to myself. So leave me to last by all means.
Go on, Dave. Take us away.
I don't think there's any one in particular, but I think the ones that I've enjoyed doing the most have been interviewing your everyday people who are just enjoying being around cars and being there for the sake of it. I mean, if I had to sort of think specifically, this is only because it's coming to mind because it was fairly recent, last year's Festival of the Unexceptional. It was just being in a sea of geekdom with people who are utterly unashamedly geeky about what they were doing. Loved being there for what they were doing, loved being there for being amongst other people and just reveling in enjoying what they were doing. And these people were so enthusiastic. There was not a difficult moment talking to any of them because, to be perfectly honest, I was with my own people, really. It was lovely. It's really, really nice. Just talking to people who are enthusiastic and who can articulate what it is that is, no pun intended, driving them being there. Anyone in the classic car fraternity is another, you know, anyone who's passionate about what they do in general, whether it's motoring or not, is good to talk to because the enthusiasm carries a huge amount of weight. But, you know, in our field, talking to people who are absolutely nailed on enjoying the experience of their hobby, I think that's it's very uplifting. It's very comforting to know that there are other people who think along the same lines as yourself, and you know, it gives you hope that the hobby and the love that we have for cars, you know, the industry's changing dramatically. There's a lot of reason to be quite anxious about certain elements of automotive ownership, of driving cars. Are we still going to be able to drive them? Are they going to be driving us? What, you know, there's more and more restrictions. To go and speak to people who have such a care and enthusiasm for what they're doing, it gives you hope and makes you think things are probably going to be all right. That's it, really. Not a person, more a movement, I think.
Yeah.
I think for me, it was probably Karun Chandhok, I think. So we've had a few, obviously not as many as Dave or Helena, as he appears on this on this program, Graham. And but he was just that random doorstep of oh, there he is. Mm. Oh, can we have a chat? And shove the microphone in his face. But it wasn't really. There was no structure. There was no pre-planning, no nothing, was there? There's ones that we've done much research, or at least 5 minutes research for, and tried to stick to a script. Karun was just oh, hello, mate, shall we have a chat? And we just had a chat, and he was an absolute gentleman.
Thoroughly nice guy.
A petrol head through and through, and, yeah, just the sort of guy that you'd want to go out for a beer with at the end of the day, and just, yeah, thoroughly nice chap. Really nice bloke.
Yeah, very nice guy.
To be honest, exactly what I was going to say, a thoroughly nice guy. And I think one thing that, and I know I've said it before, but one thing that you don't necessarily realise, or at least I didn't realise, is how much a lot of the big names that we know and that we follow and we respect and we see racing at the top echelons of motorsport, how many of them are just car guys, and they are quite happy just to have a chat. We had a fantastic day where we interviewed George Russell and Kubica and Bottas as well. Bottas was hilarious, a stoic facial expression, but we started off chatting about M&M and was a really enjoyable interview, and one that, to be honest, I was probably a bit nervous about, really, because you know, you don't want to ask the same questions that everyone else asks. You think they must get very bored of it. One person I really enjoyed talking to, and I would love to talk at length to, and again, an absolute gentleman, is Tiff Nadell. Tiff is such a nice guy. He comes across as a nice guy and very enthusiastic, but he is genuinely an absolute gentleman, and he has so much time for you. Even when he doesn't have time, he still has time for you. So, yeah, Tiff, I think, is one of those guys that I'd really like to chat to at some more length and share a beer with.
We've all referred to Goodwood, and Goodwood has been very good to me over many, many years, and I've had some extraordinary encounters with people there. And people that both you and Jim and David have mentioned that I've also spoken to. And there's so many of them are such nice people and so happy to give of their time. And some are very, very notoriously unapproachable, but still we've been successful. One of the, I think, the best interviews that I think I ever did, the most striking interview, was talking to Nigel Mansell in the collecting area at Goodwood. And Murray came over and joined in. So we basically did a three-way, I can't call it an interview because it wasn't structured at all. But the producer in my ear, this went out live. As far as I'm aware, there's no record of it. But it went out live and it was about 10 minutes. And the producer in my ear was saying, keep going. Because, you know, just getting the two of them together, chatting like the old mates they were, and I felt very warm about being included in that. And it's great. I really enjoyed it. Another one, and I think Andrew will remember this one, where we were set up in the media centre. And everybody said, oh, Jenson Button, no. He won't do one-on-ones. He's only going to do something on the stage. And we had conversations with the people around Jenson. And he'd said, yeah, okay, we'll do something. Because we'd interviewed him several times before. So we had this studio set up, and we completely ignored him while he was on the stage, finished his stage interviews, 15, 20 minutes, whatever it was. And then he came over and sat down with us for about 10 minutes. Very nice interview. More difficult to arrange, I think, was one of my favourite interviews, which I still listen to occasionally, sort of trying to teach myself how I should have done it. And that was Frank Williams. And basically his people had said, no, he's not doing any interviews. And I finally did manage to persuade them to let me have a few minutes with him. And at that time, he was going through choosing the next pair of drivers. And, you know, I knew everybody was saying, oh, you're going to have this, going to have that, all the local scuttlebutt and all the rumours that were going up and down. And I didn't do that. You know, I just structured it completely differently. Okay, you're not going to tell me who you're choosing, but I am intrigued by how that's chosen. Who makes those decisions? You know, who has input into those decisions? And I can't remember how long it runs, maybe 7-8 minutes, but it was insightful into the way Frank Williams did things. And I very much enjoyed that and his time and really good company, but better company, best company of all. And I can't resist mentioning him because I've interviewed him so many times, and I came to regard him as a friend, and Susie, his wife, thought I was a safe pair of hands to leave him with. He wouldn't get into any trouble if he was talking to me, which was usually the case. But just the amount of time that I've spent talking to Stirling Moss over the years, courtesy of Goodwood and Andrew, I remember we've made some films for Stirling in his home, in his office, and so on and so on. Great character, really, really always enjoyed his company, always enjoyed the fact that you could just turn the mic off after a few minutes. You'd done what you set out to do. The rest was just a conversation between friends and between people with a common interest. Exactly as you were saying, it's all about people with a common interest. And he was just on anything to do with motorsport, who was up and coming, who did what in the 1950s, which friends he'd lost, and so on. He was enormously entertaining, even right at the very end when clearly he was having some problems with his memory. He was still an absolutely charming gentleman to talk to.
Well, there we are. We knew you'd win that one, Graeme. Well done.
Sorry, it's just right place, right time, and before most of you were even born, I was pounding those beats. So, you just got to know people.
I have to say, from a professional point of view, I got to listen to an awful lot of your interviews because it was me that edited a lot of them for going on air and wherever Indeed. Else they were going. And it was always a treat. I mean, sort of, I remember the Frank Williams one very well because It's exactly as you say. He wasn't going to tell you who was going to be driving for him, but the insight into how his mind worked. He had a very, very sharp mind. His body might not be willing, but his mind was absolutely pin sharp. Exactly. And it was fascinating to listen to him. I mean, I was just looking back through some old photos I found the other day. There's you interviewing Christian Horner back in the days before he was Christian Horner. He was just starting in Red Bull before all the fame, fortune, and all the other unpleasantness that there has been of late. And the Jenson Button interview you mentioned, because I remember that, him coming straight across to us, being guided. He was hot property.
Yeah, and his PR people were being very protective, as they often were. I can remember being led by a security team alongside one of the Japanese drivers whose name escapes me. And the security team had us all hands on each other's shoulders, getting us through the crowd, But, another great gentleman is, I'm writing my memoir here as we go, David Coulthard, who was a great character and I've interviewed a number of times. But first time I interviewed him was just before the start line at Festival of Speed. And the marshals wanted him to move the car. And I'd only spoken to him for a few minutes. And he then said, I'll come back in a minute. I thought, I've been there before. But he did. He came back and gave me another 5 or 10 minutes. And didn't need to. He was already by that stage of, top-class racing driver, very well known. But very generous with his time. As wasn't a certain Ferrari driver, who, even as he climbed onto the helicopter, was still promising me an interview that he never gave me. But that was just after he'd broken the car on the Sunday afternoon, and all the mechanics hated him for that.
Naming no names.
No, indeed. Major property developer these days, I believe. Crap racing driver.
And I would just like to say thank you to everyone that also shares our passions with us, because without you, what are we? So it's been a pleasure to sit here and chat to you. I really hope that all of you have enjoyed listening to some of our favourites from over the years, best and worst, and that you've enjoyed this 200th podcast. You can find us online. We are at UK Motor Talk everywhere. And of course, we have an incredible back catalogue of all the people that we've spoken to, podcasts that we've created for your listening entertainment. And all of that is available online, or at least most of it is. So I want to say thank you very much for listening to us today. And we'll see you next time. So from me, Mike, goodbye.
From me, Jim, it's goodbye. Take care.
From me, Graham, it's goodbye. Look after yourself. Safe driving.
And from me, Dave, I'll just say brace yourselves for another 200 episodes because, I don't know about you, I've got nothing else to do. So, see you in a couple of weeks for 201. Take care.
Bye-bye.
UK Motor Talk, a First Take Media production.